Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glass Lewis conference call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode for this call. Institutional investors that would like to ask questions of the participants may do so by entering your question into the area marked Questions on the lower right part of your screen. Before we get started, I'd like to remind everyone that our conference call series, and this call in particular, should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass Lewis & Co. Glass Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the Securities and Exchange Commission, nor will it. This call is for information purposes only and should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass Lewis makes no representation regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement, information, opinion, or view presented by its guests, by our speakers. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded and will be available on the Glass Lewis website. Now that I've got that out of the way, hello everyone and welcome to today's proxy season preview. My name is Andrew Geblin and I'm the Senior Director of Proxy Research at Glass Lewis. Today we'll be discussing highlights of the 2016 proxy season in Europe. Joining me are my colleagues Carla Topino, Associate Vice President of European and Emerging Markets Policy, and Dmitry Zagorov, Manager of UK and European Compensation. If you have questions today regarding the call, please use the question box on the webinar and we will address them during a Q&A session later in the call or respond to you at a later date. Today we're going to be reviewing some regulatory updates and Glass Lewis policy updates for Europe as a whole. Then I will be talking about market-by-market updates in some of the key markets. And we're going to finish with Dmitry talking about some key focus areas in remuneration in Europe. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Carla to talk about European updates for 2016 season. Sorry about that, folks. Looks like we're having some technical difficulties. So we're going to jump ahead to Dmitry to talk about some remuneration developments while we try to fix the line.
Hey, thank you, Andrew. We're going to start off on the next slide with some EU-wide regulatory developments, specifically updated guidelines from the European Banking Authority on rules for pay at financial institutions. Now, in November, the EBA released an updated opinion on role-based allowances. These allowances were introduced by particularly UK institutions as a way of offsetting the reduced incentive opportunity that resulted from the 2-to-1 ratio between fixed and variable pay, more commonly known as the bonus cap. These allowances have caused quite a bit of concern, particularly from the continent, that they were effectively serving as a way around the bonus cap. The EBA's opinion on them is a bit less clear on how an allowance would count as fixed pay than on what would disqualify it, but red flags that they've identified include when they're set on a discretionary basis or sort of reverse engineered to make up the difference between fixed and variable opportunities, when they're linked to working achievements, and when they're revocable. So we should see UK banks perhaps revise their allowances to reflect the guidance. The EBA has also revised its guidelines on the valuation of LTI, long-term incentive awards. The problem here was really just when to recognize the awards for the purpose of the bonus cap, at grant or at vesting. Since many long-term awards are granted over shares, there was a concern that an award worth, say, 100% of fixed pay at grant could be worth significantly more than that at vesting due to share price increases during the performance period. So the EBA has clarified that for these forward-looking awards, they can be included and valued for the bonus cap in the year that they're granted. Last order of EBA business is the extension of pay regulations to smaller financial institutions. This was originally expected to take place in 2016, but has been pushed back to 2017. There are two distinct elements here, the actual bonus cap and then the structure of variable payments within that cap. That is the duration of deferral before awards are released, whether they can be paid in cash or need to be paid in shares or other instruments. Now, in terms of the bonus cap, that is still on the books for 2017. A number of member states have already indicated that they'll decline to apply it for smaller institutions, but it does appear to be going forward under the law. Now, in terms of the structure of variable payment, that has been tabled pending further consultation, and there appears to be more scope for smaller institutions to be granted an exemption. Moving on to the next slide, there are several issues to touch on in the French market this year. In terms of regulatory developments, the Macron law came on the books in August. There are two aspects that should have an impact on compensation proposals. First off, the law reduces the amount of time that free shares need to be held before they're eligible for favorable tax treatment, from a total of 4 years to a total of two. Now, free shares are used for all employee plans or broad-based schemes as well as for executives, and the change is it's primarily intended to promote share ownership. But in terms of executive compensation, there is potential for companies to reduce the performance and or holding period. Now, Glass Lewis is a firm believer in long-term alignment between executives and shareholders. We generally look for a minimum 3 year for a long-term award. So that's something that we're going to be looking at quite closely. In addition, some French companies offer supplementary top hat pensions in addition to standard retirement arrangements. And under Macron, the supplemental payments will now be subject to performance criteria, similar to how severance payments are treated in France. So we expect any companies utilizing a top hat pension to revise its terms in line with the law. Now, France saw a relatively high level of shareholder opposition on pay proposals last year. One of the common themes was clarity of disclosure provided, particularly with regard to variable pay and bonus determinations. And so we expect improved disclosure in this area, particularly from larger companies and those that had a significant shareholder opposition last year. Another area of focus would be exit payments. There were a couple of incidents after the 2015 season with departing executives receiving extremely large awards. And the AMF, the market regulator, got involved in a couple of those cases and has now called for comprehensive disclosure requirements on payments to a departing executive. Moving on to the next slide. In the UK, it has been a relatively restrained year on the regulatory front. One thing I did want to note is a change in pension taxation that will take effect this spring. That will increase the burden on high accruals under defined benefit schemes and on matching contributions in defined contribution schemes. That's both on the employee and the employer. And just as a result, we may see companies amending their approach to retirement for executives and other high earners. More broadly, similar to France, we expect the level of disclosure provided by remuneration committees to be an area of focus. In particular, the disclosure of performance targets. And in particular, there are companies that claim their performance targets are commercially sensitive and whether they're willing to disclose them retrospectively, either at the end of the year or setting some date in the future. Beyond the everyday, disclosure regarding sort of one-offs and unusual situations, areas where the existing remuneration policy provides quite a lot of leeway to the committee, we expect to see increased focus on. Most of the large UK pay revolts in 2015 were related to these types of situations, particularly joining awards. And so we really expect companies to sort of try and move beyond boilerplate and try and put a bit more thought into their disclosure in these areas this coming year. Moving on to our last slide, just wanted to highlight an area that we expect to receive a bit more attention than in previous years. That would be adjustments. Now, many companies rely on adjusted earnings or profit measures for determining bonuses and other award payouts, and the adjusted figures are often very, very different from the statutory results. This reflects things like treatment of exceptional items as defined by the company, and historically it's been particularly relevant for industries such as banking, pharmaceuticals. Though in recent years we've seen currency fluctuations cited by companies in a wide variety of sectors across the market. There's particularly an issue in the UK where the Financial Reporting Council has provided a bit of guidance, sort of encouraging companies to move away from exceptional-based reporting. Now, I wouldn't look for many companies to abandon adjusted figures for statutory results, but we do expect to see a bit more transparency and additional disclosure regarding the adjustment process and sort of explaining how they got to those figures. Finally, just wanted to highlight an industry that we expect to be of particular interest in terms of pay proposals this season across the markets. That would be the natural resources sector. We are well into a commodities downturn now, and in the past year, oil and gas producers were really hit hard by falling prices. So it should be very interesting to see how boards treat the market downturn when setting variable payouts. And if you could possibly invest in the usage of a particular word in public company filings, I think you'd do quite well putting your money on normalization, as many companies seek to explain why exactly they've reduced their targets so much. And that's about it for remuneration. I want to pass things back to Andrew.
Hey, we're going to give it another try with Carla and see if her line is working a little better now.
Hello.
Carla?
Hello. I'm here. I'm back. Better. I hope so. So I will try to, again, to talk a little bit about the regulatory updates at European level. I was before briefly mentioning the status with regard of the revision to the shareholder right directive has been quite a lengthy procedure, and still at the moment it's unclear when the document will be finalized. It's a regulation with a very broad scope, touching on very sensitive issues, including remuneration and related party transactions, for example. As we can see from the slide, it summarizes the current status of the discussion with regard to say on pay and related party transactions. With regard to say on pay, the Parliament, when voting in plenary session during the summer, it confirmed the vote, the shareholders' vote on the remuneration policy to be held at least every 3 years. However, it now gives flexibility to member states to decide whether that vote should be binding or advisory in nature. So it gives more flexibility to companies. The vote on remuneration policy will be also based on the text approved by the Parliament, coupled with a vote on the report, an annual advisory vote on the remuneration report. In case of a rejection of the report, the company should consider the reasons behind the shareholders' dissent and explain in the next report how the negative vote has been taken into account. The other areas where member states have shown dissenting opinions is the area of related party transactions. Now, again, according to the text that has been approved by the Parliament, it will be up to each member state to define what constitutes a material transaction. A huge debate was indeed triggered by what threshold should be used to define the materiality of the transaction. And ultimately, the Parliament approved an amendment to the original proposal made by the Commission, according to which member states will define the material transactions based on a number of criteria, and could possibly also introduce quantitative standards, but it will be again up to each member state. One of the provisions that no longer appears in the text approved by the Parliament is a reference to loyalty measures that the legal affairs committees were recommending, including loyalty dividends, loyalty shares. The Parliament rejected the amendment in the final, in the plenary session. Moving to the next slide, it's an update on a piece of regulation that is in force, contrary to the shareholders' right directive, that is still the revision to the shareholders' right directive that is still pending. The directive on non-financial reporting was approved 2 years ago, and December of this year will be the final deadline for member states to implement the regulations into their national laws. The directive calls for disclosure of important information regarding, among others, environmental and social matters, as well as board diversity by large companies. What is interesting is that the Commission is currently working on non-binding guidelines that should clarify and provide assistance to companies on the methodology to follow to provide such disclosure. We should also recall that the directive leaves quite a degree of flexibility to companies, allowing them to choose which standards should be referred to and also where the information should be included. Finally, the directive on the audit directive was again a directive approved 2 years ago. The transposition deadline is again this year, summer of this year. Most member states are currently in the process of updating or implementing the regulation, the new regulation, into their national laws, with some, with only three member states actually already that have already enacted national legislation. There were recently some concerns actually raised over the implementation of this deadline, as it allows a certain degree of flexibility. There have been some fears that large companies operating on a cross-border basis might face difficulties if member states decide to implement differently the new rule. Moving now to some updates to our European guidelines. First of all, board elections. We have changed our approach in case of insufficient information regarding the background of candidates, where previously we recommended against, we recommended an abstention. We are now recommending against the nominee if the company does not disclose sufficient information to allow an evaluation of the background of the candidate, his or her affiliations with the company. Our policy, I apologize, but I have a bad cough, so I apologize, my apologies. our policy regarding overboarding, our previous limits, 6 and 3, for executive and non-executive directors, respectively, have now changed and lowered to 5 and 2, respectively. We will still take into account a number of aspects, a number of factors when making our evaluation, including whether or not, including the attendance records, the rationale provided by a company regarding the reasons why that board member is still considered to be the best candidate for the board despite the large number of outside board memberships. Also, we will not be considering generally non-listed companies, so there are a number of mitigating factors and elements that will play a role in our evaluation. With regard to board diversity, we will pay closer attention to how the companies are addressing diversity issues. We expect certainly companies to comply with legal requirements and with best practices establishing that market. Our policy for this year is actually intended to highlight and to identify the outliers, being those large companies that have failed to nominate any women to the board or to disclose any relevant policy, identifying the steps that the companies intend to take with regard to diversity. And in those instances, we will recommend against the chairman of the nominating committee. Moving to the next slide, we have updated our policies in case of lack of disclosure regarding audit fees and excessive audit fees, non-audit related fees. So in both instances, our policy, our approach will be the same. We will be targeting the board's authority to set the auditor's fees with a negative recommendation in case of failure to disclose the fees or in case of excessive non-audit related fees. If the issue persists over subsequent years, we will recommend against the chairman of the audit committee. Should the company not offer a separate vote on the board's authority to set the auditor's fees, we will raise our concerns through the appointment of the auditor by recommending against that proposal. In case of share issuances, we will scrutinize proposals to issue shares at a significant discount based on market price. And we will be expecting companies to provide a clear rationale for that discount. Finally, with respect to environmental and social risk, we will be better incorporating our analysis of environmental and social risk into our board evaluation, thereby potentially recommending against the directors that are responsible for risk oversight in case we believe that the company, the board, has failed to identify risk, material risk, or properly manage risk that had an impact on shareholders' value or might have had a significant impact on shareholders' value. This concludes the overview of European regulatory development as well as an update on policy guidelines. I will turn over to Andrew for regional updates. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. And to our listeners again, apologies for the technical difficulties and thank you for bearing with us. Well, the regulations at the EU level are, of course, of perhaps even increasing importance in Europe. And there are still market-by-market developments that we think bear teasing out a bit. So I'd like to talk about some of those, starting with the UK. And one very interesting development in the UK has been the regulatory requirement for companies now to issue a viability statement, which is separate from the going concern statement, which we've historically seen in annual reports. The viability statements will definitely be subject to increased shareholder scrutiny this year as they're looking for how to identify relevant information. To date, many of the viability statements that we have seen have been relatively boilerplate, although there are some emerging trends or best practices in reporting. And typically, we've seen that companies are setting three-year viability statements that match their three-year strategic plans, although they're able to set other periods of time for evaluating the company's viability. While this is an area of interest, we don't expect it to generate a lot of shareholder concerns in the coming year as shareholders still learn to digest what information is actually included. In the UK, of course, diversity is a hot topic as in the rest of Europe. In contrast to the contemplated regulation on diversity at the EU level and the regulatory approach that many EU member states have taken, the UK has taken a more organic approach to improving board diversity in the boards of its largest companies. While the FTSE 100 already met its 25% target for women on boards in October, very recently, the new target on which most shareholders are focused is the 33% target for the boards of all FTSE 350 companies. We've seen substantial gains in this area in the past year, but we expect to see continuing gains this year as companies strive for that 33% target by 2020. In general, companies are providing much more information on their diversity policies and a progress towards them, which is now required, but most reports tend to be fairly boilerplate. Nevertheless, we see this as a step forward in terms of disclosure in the UK on the important topic of diversity. Another topic that is being discussed at the EU level, and as Carla mentioned, there are regulations that have already been finalized and a directive at the EU level. The UK has taken a step forward on mandatory audit rotation in advance of this directive and regulation. FTSE 350 companies are required to tender their audit every 10 years, and this has to be done by June 2016, so just a few months' time. We expect to see most companies who haven't already rotated their auditor doing so this proxy season. However, it's worth noting that there are transitional provisions for companies that have had auditors for more than 10 years, which means that some companies, particularly those who have already had an auditor for the same auditor for 20 years may be able to postpone the rotation of their auditor until 2020. Of course, with the EU audit directive and regulation, there are still some provisions that need to be ironed out and put into UK law. And as a result, those are being evaluated right now to see what changes might still need to be made, particularly with regard to the classification of non-audit related fees. One very welcome change in the UK that we are looking forward to is better disclosure when a proposal has received significant opposition from shareholders in the previous AGM. Companies are now recommended to disclose the actions they intend to take in the face of such opposition, and if they know the reasons for the dissent, to explain what those reasons are. This is something that has historically been lacking, not only in the UK, but in most companies, countries in Europe. And so it is, in our view, a very welcome change for shareholders. However, of course, companies are still left with the discretion to decide what constitutes significant opposition. The GC100 working group suggests using a general standard of 20% of votes against as a guideline. However, it's recognized that this could change based on a company's shareholder structure or the issues that actually caused the significant against vote. So there should still be some variation in companies' responses to this recommendation. On a more administrative note, the authorities to issue shares are not usually particularly controversial in the UK. In most cases, companies seek to waive the preemptive rights of shareholders only up to 5% of the total share capital. However, as of last year, there's been new guidance provided by the Investment Association and Preemption Group that recommends companies have the ability to waive preemptive rights up to 10% of their share capital for specific acquisitions and investments. Well, that was a new proposal last year. We may see more uptake of this recommendation this year, so we're watching that. From our point of view, this is not a particularly controversial issue. There are a few key meetings to watch in the UK for this coming year. Most of these are with regard to pay issues, which, as always, are quite controversial, particularly in light of the market slowdown. Some environmental and social concerns and governance issues as well. Moving on to France. We do expect a slightly quieter season in France this year after what we could call the shareholder spring in 2015. The shareholder spring was essentially a result of the Florange Act, which pitted institutional investors against boards in many cases, and actually against the French government as well. Some of the effects of the act are still felt this year, including that double voting rights provisions actually become effective at the end of this month. Companies had until March 31st, 2016 to opt out of this provision. If they didn't, and many companies didn't, shareholders holding shares for more than 2 years in the same account will automatically be granted double voting rights. While there's no particular action to be taken on this front this year, we do expect it to cause some controversy. Shareholders see that in many cases, institutional shareholders, and particularly foreign institutional shareholders, are not included in this generous provision. In addition, one of the things that happened last year with the Florange Act was the reversal of neutrality principles. As a result, all proposals to issue shares and convertible securities, which are quite common in the French market, continue to have the potential to be used as anti-takeover devices. Well, many companies opted out of this possibility last year. It will still certainly be an issue of significant concern for shareholders in 2016. The Macron Act was the kind of most significant legislation from a corporate governance perspective affecting 2016. As Dimitri already discussed, these primarily affect pension schemes and some of the vesting provisions for long-term incentive plans. So I'm not going to discuss those again. But another act to be aware of is the Rebsamen Act. which will potentially increase the number of employee representatives on the boards of French companies, which of course in turn can sometimes be a controversial topic with regard to shareholder rights. Smaller firms will now be required to have employee representatives on the board, as the threshold for the total number of employees in France has changed from 5,000 to 1,000 employees, so a much lower number. In addition, shares that are held by employees outside of an official shareholding plan will also be used in calculating the thresholds for entitling employees to representatives on the boards of public companies. Typically, that's above 3%, so it's many companies actually do exceed this threshold, and particularly with the new method of calculating these rights associated with employees. One interesting development, although perhaps not much used, will be that the AFEP-MEDEF Code of Corporate Governance now recommends that shareholders have a consultative vote on the sale of assets representing more than 50% of a company's total assets. Indeed, that is quite a significant transaction, so we're not sure how many of those we would actually see, but it is, from our perspective, a positive step forward in terms of shareholder rights in France. Corporate governance reporting and compliance with best practice standards has improved in France in the past 2 to 3 years, or perhaps more, as a result of both the AMF report, that's the regulatory oversight body in France, and their annual report on corporate governance practices, which actually names and shames specific companies for complying or not complying with key governance recommendations, and particularly the spirit of transparency. The AFEP-MEDEF code also, the AFEP-MEDEF organization also has a high committee for corporate governance, which in 2015 produced its second annual report, giving issuers guidance on how to improve their disclosure and also just practices in the spirit of the AFEP-MEDEF corporate governance code, which is indeed the main corporate governance code for French companies. There are a few key meetings to watch here for France. Most of these are ones where we expect perhaps some response to the report of the AMF, which I've just mentioned, significant shareholder opposition to proposals at the 2015 meeting, or shareholder responses to the implementation of double voting rights, which in some companies was a very close call at the 2015 meeting. Moving on to Benelux, there are not quite as many developments here as might be expected in the Netherlands, but one thing that's interesting to note is that audit reform in the Netherlands, like in the UK, was also ahead of the curve from the EU directive and regulations. And the Netherlands actually has much stricter audit rotation requirements with an 8-year rotation period that has begun this year. So many firms have already begun rotating their auditors, and we've seen several proposals to that effect so far, and expect many others to follow suit. The Netherlands also had expanded audit reports, which already began last year. Many of those actually prompted more questions than they did providing answers, but it was a useful start in the dialogue between auditors, the board, and shareholders on identifying some of the material risks at Dutch companies. We expect that to continue to be one of the dominant themes in shareholder meetings this year, as shareholders better incorporate this information into their decision-making process. The Dutch Governance Code is actually under revision. As I said, there are not a lot of developments taking effect for 2016. Perhaps it's worth noting because the Dutch Code, unlike many other corporate governance codes in Europe, have actually not been updated since 2008. The direction of the code is quite interesting. The consultation focuses on creating long-term value, improving risk management systems, integrating culture into a full assessment of corporate governance, and improving accountability systems between the board, management, shareholders, the auditor, and other stakeholders. And so we'll be watching that consultation, which closes shortly, and the resulting amendments to the code very closely. In Belgium, There are no major regulatory or corporate governance updates to report. However, one thing that's quite interesting from our perspective is a general trend for higher independence standards, which have historically been quite low relative to other EU countries. The recommendations of the Belgian Corporate Governance Code simply specify that three directors out of the total, regardless of the total number of directors, should be independent. While many companies previously only benchmarked themselves against this very low standard, in recent years we've seen leading companies, particularly those on the BEL 20 index of Belgium's largest and most liquid companies, improving the total independence of their board, mostly based on feedback from shareholders. As a result, following this market trend, we have updated our guidelines for Belgium to require 50% independence on the board of BEL 20 companies. Moving on to Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, a few developments worth noting here. One issue that may have been lingering for institutional investors voting in Germany was the possibility for shares to be not blocked, but perhaps prevented from trading for a short period of time due to a technical issue that was a result of a court ruling for the past several years. That applied only to bearer shares. However, a recent court ruling has provided more clarity, and the potential for share blocking or quasi-share blocking has now been removed from Germany, and it should no longer be a significant concern for shareholders. Obviously, that's a positive development. But one other development is the binding diversity quota for large boards in Germany. This is specifically for women. That takes effect already this year for all elections that are held in 2016 and beyond. Boards must have 30% women. This is quite a striking departure from the previous efforts in Germany to improve board diversity in the same manner as the UK through voluntary methods. So now companies are actually being required to meet these standards. The MTC provisions already take effect from this year, meaning that if a board does not meet this 30% target, an election of a new nominee will be deemed invalid until the company meets this target. So that's, of course, quite a strict provision. Of course, it's worth noting that in Germany, the election of directors can be for terms of up to 5 years, so it may take a few years still for the full 30% quota to be met. And perhaps even more interesting is that German companies are now required to disclose targets for their diversity on the management board. So far, we've seen companies tending to set fairly low standards, certainly much lower than for the supervisory board. But we are interested to see how this potentially improves the diversity of top executives at German companies. In the past year, we saw a significant rise in shareholder activism at companies in Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, and particularly in the real estate sector. There were a few companies that saw contested elections or their strategies questioned by shareholders through shareholder proposals. Well, it's impossible to say if this trend will continue with a focus on the real estate sector. So far this year, we've already seen one contested election at Convert Immobilien in Austria, another real estate company. So we'll be watching to see if that trend holds true for the rest of this region. Switzerland is actually fairly quiet this year, for once, after the Minder initiative, also known as the Initiative Against Fat Cat Salaries, has been fully implemented, requiring binding votes on pay and annual elections of directors, among other provisions. And while the final legal requirements are actually still being debated, companies have implemented all the transitory provisions, and we don't expect to see significant changes this year, except perhaps in better disclosure of binding votes on board and executive fees, particularly where companies saw significant opposition last year, which was not many. We have noted that Switzerland, as not a member of the EU, perhaps has been less focused on the issue of board diversity. while there's definitely an improvement in general, there's still a number of Swiss boards, even of large and mid-cap companies, with no women and no realistic plan to address this disparity. So that's something that might be of particular interest this year. Of course, Volkswagen will be a huge meeting to watch as a result of this scandal. That meeting has actually been postponed till June. As usual, Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse will come under fire for pay plans and succession issues. In the Nordic region, that's Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and Norway. We have a few developments that are worth noting for 2016. After a corporate spending scandal, this is a jet scandal involving moose hunts between the auditor and the boards of public companies, including SCA and Svenska Handelsbanken, and a few other high-profile Swedish companies. We've seen in the past year the gradual unwinding of industry burdens cross-shareholdings. So a lot of Swedish companies previously had cross-shareholdings, and they were all related to this group, Industrivärden. We've seen those being gradually unwound with plans to further unwind those cross-shareholdings in 2016, in addition to a replacement of top leadership in Industrivärden and at some of the portfolio companies. From our view, again, this is generally a positive development for institutional investors and for protecting shareholder value. There is a fairly large push for reform at companies, particularly in Sweden, but also in Denmark, which is fairly organic in the sense that there are a variety of shareholder groups and public interest groups, actually other stakeholders, pushing for reform, particularly on remuneration practices. Although remuneration may be quite a bit lower in the region than in other parts of Europe and indeed globally, there is a lot of scrutiny of bonus payments, particularly when companies are not doing well, and the structure of long-term incentive plans. We're also seeing a lot of shareholder proposals and anticipate a lot of shareholder proposals on societal issues at large, ranging from everything from creating committees to push for government reform to creating diversity and equality policies within companies. On a note that is of great interest to us, we've seen some of the largest companies in Sweden proposing individual elections of directors. Historically, Swedish companies have not offered individual elections on any directors. So this is a very significant development. This has been something that we believe comes, again, mostly from dialogue with shareholders, not from regulatory authorities, but is a hugely positive development for corporate governance in Sweden and something that we look forward to hopefully seeing more of. There are not many changes in Finland. I might just note that the corporate governance code was modified last year, encouraging boards to take a focus on diversity, to report on diversity, board diversity, although Finnish companies were already, relative to other European peers, typically fairly good in this respect. It also lowered the threshold for independent directors from 12 years to 10 years. That means that now a director in Finland is considered not independent anymore after served on the board for 10 years. An interesting development from our point of view, because it does contradict European guidance that sets that threshold typically at 12 years. Not much else to note in Denmark, except just to be aware that in accordance with Danish law, all Danish companies are actually switching from bearer shares to registered shares, meaning that all shares must now be held in a registered account with the company. This follows a trend in Europe that we've seen in a number of other countries in the past few years. Moving on to Spain and Portugal. The Spanish Code of Good Governance was updated in the past year with a number of changes. Two things that are of most interest perhaps to shareholders are that there's a higher standard for board independence that is specifically for companies listed on the IBEX 35 index of Spain's largest and most liquid companies. And this is an unusual development in that It's the first time that a code calls out specific companies on the IBEX 35 for a higher standard. So now we expect that most companies on the IBEX 35 will pursue a majority independent standard for boards. The governance code also has, as we've seen in many other countries, a focus on board diversity, requesting that companies report on their progress against particular targets. Unfortunately, yet for shareholders, yet again, they are faced with a lot of amendments to the Articles of Association in Spain, which can be quite significant proposals, many, many sub-proposals, and many, many articles being amended. Most of these directly relate to the governance code, as well as some legal changes, which are, again, mostly positive for shareholders. These include audit rotation requirements that stem from the EU directive on auditors, a new law that requires audit committees to be majority independent by June 2016, as well as other provisions that generally strengthen governance. One thing that is coming up in some of these article amendments that shareholders might want to be aware of is the transfer of the authority to issue non-convertible debt instruments from shareholders to the board. So whereas previously shareholders were requested to approve the issue of any non-convertible debt instruments, now the board may be vested with this power alone. And so a lot of companies are actually amending their articles to specify that. In general, Spanish companies are improving the quality of their disclosure on both governance and remuneration practices in Spain quite a bit this year. Again, we believe this is the as output from dialogue with shareholders. Spanish companies have historically been had disclosure mapped out by regulatory authorities in specific filing requirements, and now we see that companies are often issuing additional reports that better tell the story that is unique to their companies, both in terms of governance practices and remuneration philosophy. In Portugal, I think the only real development of note is that the Portuguese governance code is under revision and has not yet been released for the 2016 season. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Carla briefly, as it is in fact her home market in Italy, just to discuss some anticipated updates for 2016.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding Italy, there was an update to the corporate governance code during the summer of last year. Two of the amendments that have been introduced are related to the role of the board, in particular with regard to the assessment regarding the effectiveness of internal control and risk management systems. So the update emphasized the role of the board in overseeing internal control, risk, and risk management. And also, with regard to sustainability, there is a recommendation for companies included in the FTSE MIB index to evaluate whether or not a sustainability committee should be set up within the board. And in case the board does not believe that necessary, it should explain how the responsibilities are allocated to other committees. With regard to our guidelines, in addition to the updates introduced at the European level, we will pay closer attention to post-termination agreements. Historically, Italy has been a market where significant severance payments and non-compete agreements have been paid to executives. So while we still recognize that practices in the market might not be still necessarily in line with international best practices, we will try to highlight the most outrageous cases. In particular, we will be expecting companies when drafting contracts for new hires to align better to European best practices. With regard to the size of the board, we have seen a trend toward decreasing the number of board members. Again, Italy, particularly in the financial sectors, has an history of very large boards. However, companies both in the financial sector and also in other industries seem to have started reducing such size. So our policy this year is intended, again, to capture the outliers, those companies that still maintain very large boards without providing any explanation for such a choice. With respect to meetings to watch, there are a number of companies, very large ones, by the way, that are going to renew their board of directors, among them Intesa and Generali. Intesa is, might be of interest because it recently changed its governance structure, moving away from a dualistic system and adopting a monistic system, which is a novelty for the Italian market. Shareholders will be now asked to vote on the new board members. Generali is also another big company with an upcoming board election of interest in this case, given the recent departure of the company's CEO. And more in general, we have seen over the last few seasons an increased presence of institutional investors, foreign institutional investors in the in Italian shareholders meeting, and also weight of the institutional investors, significant weight when it comes to the presentation of a list of candidates for board election. So we expect that trend to continue, and it will be interesting to monitor these meetings, considering that institutional investors, like it happened in the recent past, might ultimately make up the majority of the capital presented at the meeting. And that's all for Italy.
Thank you, Carla, for that update on Italy. As of right now, we don't have any questions from the audience, so I will be ending the call shortly. Thank you to Carla and Dimitri and for all of you who listened in. If you want a link to the audio, please go to our website at glasslewis.com, where you can access the call at the Glass Lewis blog. For more information about this call, other conference calls, or proxy talks, please email proxytalk@glasslewis.com. If there is ever an annual or special meeting coming up that you think warrants special attention and would merit some discussion with your colleagues, please don't hesitate to email us. Also, if you have comments about our conference calls that you wish to share with us, your feedback is always much appreciated and will be taken into account as we structure our future calls. Again, thank you for your time, and let us know if you have any questions.